Amen. All right, to wake us up a bit, let's have people come to the board and do the chart. So, Josiah, where do we begin? Yes. Where's my chair? No chair? I'll just stand. We begin with Jesus's works. Good handwriting. And we split that into what? The sound effects make it worth it. Deeds and words. Pick someone else. All right, Ricky. Jesus' works, deeds and words lead to make your era wonderful. Good. Jesus's identity. And in Matthew, hold on. In Matthew's gospel, what is Jesus' identity? What about Mark's gospel? What about Luke? No, I'm just kidding. Okay, pick someone from the other side of the room. All right, equal opportunity lashings. Jesus' identity and his works mean absolutely nothing until we get to this middle one. Jesus' accomplishments, which we split into three sections. And those three sections, pictorially depicted, are cross, resurrection, ascension. Don't forget one. Good job. All right. Pick someone else. Ooh, Kendall. Kendall's had practice with this, though. It's embedded into his mind, his very soul, tattooed on his back, in case you're wondering. Our identity! Pick one last person. All right. Our identity will naturally flow into our works. Good, good, good. This is a template or framework from which then biblical justice should naturally flow. And we started looking at the Gospels. We started looking at Jesus' identity and how it is revealed in the Gospels. We've looked at Matthew, we've looked at Mark, but I want to remind you of why we're looking there by reading this quote from Richard Hayes. Richard Hayes, talking about the Gospel of Mark, but this applies to all four. He says, when we embrace Mark's answer to the question, who do you say that I am? We are not just making a theological affirmation about Jesus' identity. We are choosing our own identity as well. Did you hear what he's saying? That makes sense. This comes from the Moral Vision of the New Testament. Fantastic book. But what he says is when we embrace the answer to the question, who do people say that I am? We are not just making theological affirmations about Jesus' identity. We're not just saying, yes, theologically, this is the answer of who Jesus' personhood is. That's not what we're doing. He says, and I agree, we are choosing our own identity as well. So this is not just an exercise in theology that we're engaged in, although that's not a bad thing. Let me just go ahead and say this too when it comes to preaching or teaching. I am not against application. I'm really not. I think that's a good thing, you know, at some point in your sermon or in your lesson to talk about application. I personally think, though, that what our churches need more of is better theology. I mean, so a lot of times people will ask me whenever I preach a sermon, they'll say, now, where was your application points in that? I'll say, oh, there weren't any. And they'll say, why not? Because if you understand the theology, you should be able to apply it on your own. And if I teach that good enough, on some level, that's all you really need. Don't get me wrong, I think there's a time and place to talk about how this manifests itself if you can't make the connections. I get it. Sometimes I need to make explicit what is not being made explicit in the theology. I mean, we'll even talk about the Good Samaritan at some point today, probably. And it's important on some level to say, let me take this to a whole new level of application to make sure you're reflecting on this text appropriately. It's okay to do that. I'm not against that. But what our churches need most of is better theology, a better picture of Jesus. Is a better picture of who he is, what he did, what he accomplished. And that will naturally lead to application because it transforms them. If they see this clearly and they are able to articulate this identity, this personhood of Jesus, this accomplishment, it will naturally be a process of embracing their own identity. And that's the beautiful mystery of the incarnation. The more that you study it, the more it actually transforms you, if you allow it. And we've talked about the different things that don't allow that. So, are we doing just exercises in theology on some level? Absolutely. And yet, we are also doing exercises in a sense of self-awareness, self-analysis, self-revelation of who we are, which ultimately lead to what we do. Let's, though, talk about Luke. Whenever we're coming to the Gospels, I'm using this interpretive framework as an entry point to talk about the identities of Jesus, in particular, the genealogies. We looked at Matthew's, which was very regal, very king-oriented. We looked at Mark's, which has no genealogy, which led us to the discussion on servanthood inside of what type of king is this. Now we're going to move to Luke's Gospel, and he does have a genealogy. Where is it? And what does he trace us back to? Why is it significant? Faith. Luke chapter 3, it traces all the way back to Adam, which is pretty interesting. If you look, and it does it in reverse order, which is a bit interesting as well. But whenever you go, when you look in verse chapter 3, verse 38, it says, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. He goes all the way back to Genesis 1 and before. Why is that significant? What is Luke communicating about the identity of Jesus that he is going to emphasize in his gospel? Jesus is what? What was that? On some level, son of God, absolutely. Although that phrase is a bit slippery. Son of God language, a lot of times in the Old Testament, doesn't have much to do with divinity. Matter of fact, it usually doesn't have anything to do with it at all. In a sense, even whenever Jesus is using it, that's not exactly the sense in which he is using it. Now, we can read back into it and accurately describe it as such. But he's not making a divine claim with the Son of God. Now, he does make divine claims, and we'll get to that in a bit, well, tomorrow. But when he's saying Son of God, usually that's king language. So Mark 1:1 begins. This is the beginning of the good news of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. They wouldn't think, oh my goodness, he just claimed he's divine. No, they would say he's claiming to be king. Why? The king was called the Son of God. Because he was the conduit, the mediator from which God was ruling his people and from which the people were subservient to God. So if even we're going to use Son of God, on some level that would just be reiterating this point. However, in my text, which I think it's appropriately translated, and maybe yours is different, in mine in chapter 3:38, Son is not capitalized like it normally is. I actually think that's the appropriate way to translate that. Why? What is being indicated by lowercase to s?
He's a creation.
Yeah, on some sense, it is moving towards the concept of we're not talking capital S title, Son of God as the King. We're talking about a genealogy, the son of this person, the son of this person, the son of this person, the son of this person. What is significant about the fact, though, that he takes it to Adam? Who was created by God. Why is that significant? What is he trying to say about the identity of Jesus by taking it back to Adam? One of the ways they answer that is just answering the question, who is Adam?
First man.
First man. Okay, so we know Adam is the first man from which the fall occurs. What then is being said about Jesus' identity if he takes it back to the first man?
It's from the beginning.
That he is man. He's human. And on some level, now don't get me wrong, we're going to talk about the divine aspect of this. But one of the things that you cannot deny, that you cannot allow your claims of divinity of Jesus, is you cannot allow those claims to swallow up his humanity. He was human. Fully human. Matter of fact, inside of the debates of the early church, this is one of the things I find very interesting about the ridiculous reconstruction of history from Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code and things like that. The ridiculousness of it is they talk about as if they articulated Jesus' divinity only in 325, the Council of Nicaea, or 381, the Nicene-Constantinople Council, or Creed. That's the first time his divinity was articulated. But I'm like, read it closer. First of all, that's not the first time it's articulated. That's just bad history. But second of all, they are very clearly also articulating he is human. Don't get me wrong. They would say he is true God of true God. He is light of light. He is fully divine. But they would say, but he is also fully human. You cannot take away his humanity. And that is essential for the story. That's essential even for accomplishments. There's this idea of the anti-humanness of Jesus. This Jesus could not have been human. That doesn't come from Christian theology. It comes from Platonic philosophy. We've talked about this. That one of the ways in which God affirms creation as good is that he becomes creation. He is begotten as a human. To say, this is not bad. It's not like material world is evil, Gnosticism. Material world is just a shadow of the true reality, which would be Platonism or Platonic philosophy. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, no, I created the material world and called it good. I created the spiritual world and called it good. And I, the true God, will become true flesh so that I can redeem all of it. And there's a part of the early church fathers that said, if he doesn't become fully human, he can only redeem that which he was. You see what they're saying in that? He can only redeem that which he actually was. Therefore, if he was not human, what would they say the problem would be? That he didn't redeem humanity. He redeemed maybe our souls, but he didn't redeem creation. He didn't redeem the bodies because he wasn't that. In the early church, the issue that they were struggling with the most is not proving the divinity of Jesus. The issue they were struggling initially was trying to prove that Jesus was still a man as well. Because in their world, what he was accomplishing, what he was able to do, and the things he was saying, and the ways in which it was backed up and accomplished, was so magnificent, they could not comprehend that this was merely a human. There's no way it was merely a human. As a matter of fact, you have this concept of what's called Docetism, which this idea that he was God in the appearance of a human, but he wasn't really human. And the early church rejects that flat out, and they say, no, he was. Look at Luke's genealogy. Where does he trace it back to? He comes from the womb of Mary, which you can trace all the way back to Adam. He was fully human. So you cannot deny his humanity based on his divinity. As a matter of fact, if you look in 1 and 2 John, this is really important. Well, on some level, maybe outside of this class, it's really important. It's really important when you're talking to people in your pews. The definition in 1 and 2 John of the Antichrist is not the future figure that's going to come back right before everything gets really bad, or that causes everything to get really bad. That's not the definition of it. Do you remember? You've even memorized this in chapter 2. What is the definition of the Antichrist? The one that what?
Denies
that Jesus came in the flesh. That is the definition of the Antichrist. Why? Because his humanity, on some level, if he is not flesh, not human, then he cannot fulfill the Hebrew passage that says, he was tempted in every way that you were, and yet was without sin. No, that's not true, because you weren't fully human. I mean, if you were fully human, you would understand the depths of my temptations, and you would have been able to shatter those strongholds. But you weren't human. You were God. You couldn't have sinned. And since you couldn't have, you don't really know what I'm going through, and frankly, you didn't really redeem all that I'm struggling with. And the New Testament emphatically says, no, he was human. And he was able to shatter everything that you're struggling with. Because he was fully tempted as a fully human, even though he was without sin. Is this making sense? The humanity of Jesus is a very important component to keep a part of the conversation. If you run away from it completely, you actually fall into an ancient heresy of Docetism. He was fully human as well as fully God. 100% of each. I know 100% plus 100% equals 200%, but that equals mystery of the incarnation. However, to deny the humanity of Jesus, in some sense, is to separate him and even to mitigate his accomplishments. Therefore, Luke's gospel, not just in the genealogy, but as we go throughout, clearly emphasizes that Jesus is human. 100% flesh. Human. It's not just his genealogy, though. His genealogy does take us back to Adam, which is quite unique. But even if you flip backwards, he is one of the only Gospels that actually has, outside of Matthew, that has a birth narrative. As a matter of fact, his is even more true, his is more extended birth narrative that we have. So even the birth of John the Baptist at the beginning of Luke is being foretold. Pre-birth of John the Baptist. Then the birth of Jesus is foretold. The pre-birth of Jesus is being told in Matthew's or in Luke's gospel. Then you go to Mary and Elizabeth. They visit each other. Mary's song, the birth of John the Baptist, and Zechariah's song. What is he doing? What is Luke doing in chapter 1? What is he emphasizing? We've already talked about it. What is he emphasizing? He's human. And then he says, all right, now I'm going to give you the most extended birth narrative of Jesus that we have in the entire New Testament. And chapter 2 begins that. Then we even have the presentation of Jesus in the temple in chapter 2. And then we even have Jesus as a boy in chapter 2, 41 and following. What is Luke doing at the very beginning of his gospel, even before he gets to the genealogy? What is he doing? What is he emphasizing? Yeah, I want you to just keep repeating it like a record. He is emphasizing his humanity. He is human. He is 100% human. And this is why this is so important for Luke. If Jesus is 100% human, then he can, in a sense, redeem 100% of humanity. You see the connection? Luke's saying, let's look at his humanity. Oh, he's human. He's human. And honestly, Luke's gospel, more than any other gospel, is focused on people. And I'm not saying the rest of them aren't. I'm saying in Luke, there is this distinct focus, this distinct emphasis on the humanity of us all, on the actual struggles of humanity, on the outcast. The other ones do this as well. We've talked about this. But Luke's gospel has a razor-focused, sharp intent of saying, he is human coming to redeem all of humanity. All of humanity. Not just a portion, not just your soul, all of it. And so we see a strong Gentile focus. Jesus rejected at Nazareth in chapter 4. We've already gone through chapter 4, where Jesus gets up and says, this is what I'm fulfilling, to proclaim the Lord's favor. To proclaim freedom to the prisoners, recovery for the sight of the blind and the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Again, even whenever Jesus articulates his ministry, it is very tangible. It is very human-centered. I'm coming to redeem humanity because I'm fully human. He keeps going. The very next thing he says in chapter 4 after that is he announces that it is Gentiles, the outcast that he's come to save, which ticks off the whole city. And he follows that theme as we go. He deals with impure spirits, the calling of the first disciples. His first healings, though, are outcasts. So he's healing the many, then he heals the leprosy, heals the man that is paralyzed. He then calls Levi, or Matthew, who eats with sinners in order to come with him. And then he starts talking about fasting and the Lord's Supper and the Lord of the Sabbath. But now we're moving towards his Sermon on the Mount. And we've gone over this some. Remember, in chapter 6, at this point, the human emphasis is really rolling. In chapter 6, he speaks his Sermon on the Mount. And he says, blessed are you who are poor. Not in spirit, poor. For theirs is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you. And most of Luke's audience is going, yeah, we know what that feels like. I mean, he's been emphasizing outcasts so much right now. It didn't surprise me that he uses the word exclude you, because people understand. This is one of the things that frustrates me whenever it comes to people analyzing New Testament text as well as the New Testament world for evidence of persecution, of injustices happening to Christians. Is a lot of times when you're reading scholarly works, they will only measure persecution of any society based off of mass killings. And if there are not mass killings, they're not being persecuted. That is a terrible definition of persecution. An atrocious one. Because persecution is always more complicated than just killing someone or beating them physically. And don't get me wrong, persecution is physical. It can be physical. Banishments to islands, beating with rods, scourging them, hanging them on crosses, killing them en masse. That is physical persecution. That is a category. But most of the oppressed of the world don't live in physical persecution type situations. They live in the non-physical, which things are like redistribution or anti-distribution of wealth. They live in contexts like exclusion from society or ostracism even within society, theologically being murdered. They live in different things like lack of sanitation, lack of education. This is injustices. This is the persecution a lot of them feel, and sometimes it is imposed on them from the top down. I am very uncomfortable with the way in which we as a country suggest that we are treating the Native Americans in a way that is honorable because of the way in which we destroyed their land and took it from them. Because physically we're no longer beating and killing them, and therefore I guess we're okay. But look at them non-physically. I mean, they're almost herded like cattle onto reservations. And then whenever they're there, their education level, the alcohol level out in these reservations, it's off the charts. And we think that they're not being persecuted still? This is kind of the idiocy of our country whenever it says, oh, racism's been cured. Is it? How many, let's look at the ratio of how many African Americans are in prisons compared to whites. Well, maybe it's because their culture, it lends itself to more violence. Maybe it's because we've imposed a non-physical persecution on them that has created a culture of violence that leads them to be committing these crimes. Maybe it's still the top-down problem. Maybe it's just a different type of subjugation. Racism is gone in this country? That is ludicrous. And I'm not just talking about the physical ones that are beating people. I'm talking about the non-physical ones that still destroy communities. You don't need to beat a community to destroy it. That's the false reality. Rome didn't need to beat every Christian to try and destroy it. You ostracize them. You make economics something very difficult for them to engage in because they have lower education. You don't give them the opportunities. You don't allow them to progress. You don't in any way, shape, or form include them in your society. Which is why in the persecution discussion in verse 22, blessed are you when people hate you, when they exclude you. That is still persecution. Or insult you. That's called slander. Stereotypes do this as well. Stereotypes is a means of slander, insult, non-physical persecution that frankly can destroy someone's entire career and life. Slander is a pretty vicious thing. So, somebody comes and slanders you by saying they were inappropriately trying to engage in sexual conversations and possibly even touching me inappropriately, which wasn't true. That slander does what to your career? Destroys it. These Christians are meeting together and they're eating like cannibals. They're incestuous. These are rumors that are going around about Christians. Or the Jews saying, they are defying the decrees of Caesar. You don't think things like these would cause problems and tension in the communities? Christians being kicked out of synagogues? Christians also being persecuted by Roman officials? Verbally? That doesn't bother people? Not to mention the fact, let's just act like one person dies in a community of 150. How will that affect the community of 150? Do they need 100 people killed in order for them to actually feel like they're being persecuted? Do they need 100 people beaten in order to feel like that they're being physically persecuted as a people? No. Your community of 150, if something happens to one person, you all feel it very deeply. And there wasn't a lot of Christians in the ancient world yet. Especially whenever they're spread out all over the empire. It's just not there yet. Therefore, the definition of persecution, your definition of persecution, especially whenever you're applying it to modern day injustices, needs to be more accurate. It needs to be broadened. Matter of fact, there's a great quote. I may be able to replicate it or at least paraphrase it by a guy named James C. Scott in his book Weapons of the Weak. And James C. Scott says, if you only look at the Malay villagers, let me give you a background. He's an anthropologist, sociologist that's studying a Malaysian community in which he is noticing that the injustices that are happening to them, he's not there to cure the injustice, he's there to observe what happens when injustices happen between a subject and a sovereign. And he's noticing the ways in which they talk against each other and things of that nature, the way in which they talk about the sovereigns whenever they're outside of the sovereign's earshot. But whenever they're there in the presence of the sovereign, they speak to them much differently. So he develops this whole concept of public transcript, a hidden transcript. You don't need to know about all that. What he noticed, though, is this. What's happening to Malaysian villagers is technology is coming into their communities. And the efficiency the technology can provide is actually destroying the economics of the entire village, because now not as many Malaysian villagers are needed to harvest the crops. So they're having to, because of the new technology and the efficiency, they're not able to even provide for their families. So their sons are having to be sent off from their families to go work, and a lot of times never even able to come back. They just send money. They're not able to marry off their wives or their daughters because they don't have enough money to provide for dowry. He says, or they're not able to provide for the feast for their family during their seasons of Ramadan because ultimately they just don't have the money to do it. He says, if you only look at the acquisition of land as a persecution, then you don't understand the depths of the pain and the anger of the Malaysian villager. Because whenever you're not able to provide for these basic things for your family, it affects you in a way that ignites an anger and a rage that at times can come out very physically. But 90% of the time, it is a non-physical reality for them. And the way he ends the quote is, he says, at once you begin to realize that dignity is not just a private thing, it is a very public thing. His whole point is to say, if you're only looking at physical things for persecution of Malaysian villagers, you're going to say, yeah, they're suffering some, but not as bad as. He says, but if you actually bring in the non-physical and you realize what they're not able to do religiously, economically, or even familially, even for their family, you begin to understand the depths of their pain and their anger and their anguish. And that brings the persecution to a whole new level. Does that make sense? You following me? Sometimes the best way for you to understand justice ministries is by actually being able to have the empathy to see the world through the person's eyes that you're trying to help and realize the depths of the pain that they're experiencing, which also in some sense will reveal the depths of the work that you're going to need to do to help restore them. It's easy to throw money at people. It's easy to throw food at people. It's very difficult to help heal the non-physical realities that ultimately they've been suffering from the most. And that's why you cannot have a Red Cross that is as effective as a Christian biblical justice ministry. You just can't. Because there's something inside of them that is broken that needs healed. And that's only, don't get me wrong, Jesus does the physical as well, but there's something inside them that's broken that needs to be healed emotionally that only Jesus can heal. That's why I love the strategy at Black Box. I love it. It's why I believe in it. It's why I'm glad to be a part of it. It's because, don't get me wrong, we are dealing with the physical reality. We are wanting to take those children out of their context and put them in a safe context. Physical displacement into a safe context. And yet, the non-physical is what really we're focused on as an organization. We have developed an entire curriculum that did not exist. Peter Buckland has been and Jeremy Wolf have been spearheading this. It did not exist for sex trafficked young boys, a complete counseling curriculum that will bring them to complete restoration emotionally. So that then if we can clean them emotionally and protect them physically, that spiritually they'll be able to thrive. It's a holistic ministry. You cannot focus on just one. These kids, even if we take them out of the brothels and keep them in a safe home, they're still suffering. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we found we were investigating, and this was shocking to me, was that there were kids that were pulled out of sex trafficking. A lot of times it was girls, because that's the primary area that a lot of people have focused. They would take the girls out of the brothels, and the girls would be at the institutions, and they would no longer be doing the sexual acts they were being forced to do. And then we were finding that some of the girls, though, actually a strong percentage, was going back into the brothels willingly. And we were dumbfounded. We were like, how is that happening? Why is that even possible? Is it because they were addicted to drugs? No, because that does happen in some brothels, by the way. They'll get them addicted to opium or to some sort of drug so that the only place they can get it and afford it is going to the brothel. But when they get there, the only way they can get their drugs is by doing the acts that makes the people money. This happens all the time. a physical way of grabbing them in so that they don't even have to keep them locked down. They'll keep coming back to work because they've got them addicted to a drug they can't afford. You see how this works? It's an evil that's just unbelievable. But these girls we found that were going back into the brothels, what we found was every time any sort of group came to visit the institution that had brought them out of sex trafficking, the girls were forced to stand up in front of everyone and retell their story. And basically, every time they retold the story, because they weren't healed from it emotionally, they had to relive it. And they said basically reliving it emotionally was much more painful than just reliving it physically. Because at least physically, on some level, you can become numb. And they were willing to go back into it so that they could just stop having to stand in front of everyone in all of their shame and relive the moment in a crowd. It's one of the reasons why we even named it Black Box. It's one of the reasons why we refuse to allow American churches to come and visit our homes. No. If you're going to give to this organization, you're going to have to give to it and trust us. And you may not, and that's okay. But we will protect these boys. They're not going to be animals or zoos that you come and get to look at as if they're on show. Because emotionally, that destroys them. And that may be the worst persecution they've been suffering. It's not going to happen. All of them, their identities will be protected. Matter of fact, all the pictures we even have on our website aren't even of any of the boys that we're dealing with. Not one of them is. Why? Because we don't want our boys to, let's say they become rehabilitated and come to the States, we don't want them to see their faces and their stories plastered all over our promo material just so that we can get more people to give more money. Because in a sense, they're being re-violated. Because their story is making money now for other people. It's exactly what their bodies were doing when they were in the brothels. You don't prostitute out your victims to make more money. That's not okay. That is an injustice. And frankly, sometimes the non-physical can be just as raping as the physical. You cannot do that to people. You must protect them. It is their story to share, not yours. It is their story if they ever want to say it again, not yours. You need to help rehabilitate them to a point where they can deal with their story, but not rehabilitate them to the point where they can become your poster child. There is a difference. Does that make sense? Non-physical persecution is a very real, a very human thing that Jesus experiences, but he also promises to those that follow him. Rejoice in the day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. For that is how their ancestors treated the prophets. How did they treat them? They hated them. They excluded them. They insulted them and they rejected them. Then he goes down and he says something very physical that we don't really like. But woe to the rich. But woe to you who are well fed now. Woe to you who laugh now. Woe to you when everyone speaks well of you. And then notice what he does in his Sermon on the Mount. He adds a woe that is very physically focused. And then he goes straight into one of the more difficult parts of human relationships. But to you who are listening, I say, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. It's a fascinating emphasis in Luke's gospel on this very point, loving your enemies. I mean, he almost overstates it. He says it all the time. And if this is written, which I actually think it is, don't tell anybody in my NT intro classes. I haven't told them my dates for the books yet. But I think this is written probably in the mid to late 70s, maybe even early to mid 80s, the books of Luke Acts. And at that time, Christian non-physical persecution was at a boiling point, especially once you get into the 90s. Non-physical persecution that at times would lead to sporadic moments of physical persecution, but the non-physical was very tense. The entire Flavian dynasty, I don't know what the Flavians are, you're saying, that's okay, don't worry about it. It's the people Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, emperors. The entire dynasty is founded upon anti-Jewish imagery. Their entire dynasty began with the destruction of the temple. The entire dynasty began leading Jews in a procession throughout the Roman Empire and celebrating their victory over the subjugated losing side, which is the Jews. As a matter of fact, even their different actions were announcing that the Roman Jupiter had conquered and defeated the Jewish Yahweh. And what the difficult part is, the Romans didn't really clearly distinguish between the Jews and the Christians at that time. And so the Christians are caught up in this as well. This non-physical persecution, because of what it is that you're pledging allegiance to, It could lead to exclusion from different trade guilds where you're not able to make money. It could lead to exclusion from different, just from society as a whole. It could lead to beatings and even death. That does happen. But it is much more common for it to be a non-physical persecution. And yet, in the middle of all that, Luke hammers on this one point. Jesus came to heal all of humanity. All that you are and all that they are. So love your enemies. He hammers on this. Which is pretty fascinating to me. We usually only like to talk about loving our enemies when we don't really have any to love. Or the ones that we actually should be loving, we turn them into animals through stereotypes and things of that nature so we don't even have to realize they're actually people. That's one of the things I found interesting. I got in this big kick 2 years ago of World War II, and I read the official Hitler biography. I read everything I could on World War II. I was reading about the Nuremberg trials. And they had this, one of the Nuremberg trials is after World War II. They take 22 of the top Nazi officials and they put them in international court to convict them of crimes, war crimes, to deal with them in a way that is different than they were dealing with the people that were in their concentration camps. It was a good step by the world. One of the things that came out in that was, one of the generals just flat out said, one of the questions that was asked on some level by a lawyer was, how could this have happened inside of Nazi Germany? He said, what happened in Nazi Germany can happen anywhere. Communist, democracy. Matter of fact, Germany was a democracy, by the way. That's one of the things I always think gets swept under the rug pretty conveniently. They elected democratically Hitler. It wasn't like he was this tyrant that seized power. They voted for him. And that has other issues with World War I, but doesn't matter at this point. One of the things he says, though, is interesting. He says, this can happen anywhere. He said, all you need is two things. Well, number one, you need to incite fear in your people. If fear is present, people will be willing to do pretty much anything. He said, number two, you need to silence the people that turn your enemies into humans. You have those two elements, you can do anything you want. Now process that for a moment. Take the advice from someone that, in a sense, led one of the most atrocious genocides in the history of the world. What is it that we need in order for that to be a reality? Or what is it that we need to attack in order for that to not be a reality? Number one, we need to get people to not be afraid. And what are they afraid of most? Well, they're afraid of their own death, their own self-preservation. They'll do anything to keep themselves secure. It's interesting that the number one command throughout the New Testament and even the Bible is do not fear. It's interesting. And a lot of that has to do with this. Number two, you've got to shut up the people that make the enemies no longer beasts to be disposed of or animals to be wiped out or savages. Even notice the language in which we used to speak of the Native Americans. We're using a language that denigrates them below human. Why? Because if they're below human, you can do whatever you want to them. Anything you want. If you silence those people, in other words, the people that are crying out, love your enemies, if you shut them up and you have fear, you can mobilize an entire nation to do whatever you want. And when you do it, they'll thank you. Does that make sense, what he's saying? It's interesting to me that Luke's gospel is constantly saying, you have to love your enemies. Why? If Jesus is fully human, and he experiences all the temptations of humanity, and he has come to redeem all of humanity. You don't get to pick and choose who gets redemption. You don't get to pick and choose who deserves or doesn't deserve this salvation, this restoration. You have to be willing to embrace all of it. Which is why I find it interesting with the love of enemies coming right there, and he hammers it in a pretty strong way. Matter of fact, let's go ahead and just read it. Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn to them the other also. If someone takes your coat, do not hold your shirt from them either. Give to everyone who asks you. And if anyone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even the sinners love those who love them. We should be different on some level. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? You mean I need to lend to someone that I know can't repay me? Yeah. Yeah, it's not an investment that you're looking for a return on. It's called sacrificial giving. knowing you're not going to get anything back. Have you ever stopped and thought about the sacrifice Jesus made and how much, what he gets for that? He dies on the cross for the redemption of all humanity, and we treat it like it's no big deal by just living our lives of sin as if that's just the way it is. I had somebody sitting in my chair not too long ago who just flat out said, well, we'll always have sin in our lives. I said, boy, you sound like you say that as if you've just accepted that. As if, well, Jesus, you're just always going to have to work a little harder for me because I'm just not going to get rid of any sin. That's just not possible. Well, my goodness, why don't you just wave the white flag? Just go have sex with your girlfriend then. What's the difference? Sin's a sin's a sin. If you're already just committing to that lifestyle, that might as well just go do it then. Live it up. I mean, if it's already going to happen, this is exactly what Paul's dealing with in Romans. If because of Jesus' grace is constantly expanding in order to help our sin, should we go on sinning? And what is his response? By no means. That cannot be the goal. What you've just said there is, number one, you've justified yourself for living in a life of sin. And number two, you've just waved the white flag. Well, I'm terrible. I'm going to sin anyway. Okay, listen, you might, but that can't be the goal. You're speaking as if that is just a reality that you're just, well, that just is what it is. No, it isn't what it is. That is the enemy that you should be targeting through the way in which you live your life and the way in which you submit to the Spirit cleansing you. That's the goal, is to eradicate sin, not to embrace it as an ever-present reality of your life from here on out. Are you saying that I'll be perfect one day? I'm saying that's the goal. Be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. That's not hyperbole. If Jesus was not truly human, see, on some level what we're saying is, it is not possible to live truly as a human and not sin. That's what we're saying. On some level, you're denying the humanity of Jesus. You see what I mean by that? On some level, you are. Oh, it's not possible to live as a human and not sin. Well, then what was Jesus? If he was fully human, well, he was also fully God. Okay. But if his God component destroys his ability to sin, then he's not fully human. He can't be. Tempted in every way and yet was without sin. Well, tempted in every way with the buffer of the God card. No, no, no. If his divinity swallows up his humanity, then you don't even know who you are or who you're supposed to be or how you're supposed to live. I reject categorically this idea of, well, I'm going to sin, therefore I'm just going to live a life of ridiculousness. No, that's not the goal. It's just not the goal. Becoming like Jesus is the goal. And if he is truly human, then in a sense, it should be revealing how you're truly human. Does that make sense? You follow me? So now, don't get me wrong, I would push back the other way of like, hey, don't beat yourself up over one sin. I would do that as well. Because that's a part of the truth. And we'll get to that once we get to the accomplishment of the cross. You don't have to just destroy yourself over the sin. However, you do need to understand the goal here. It is to be truly human in the way in which Jesus was truly human. And that is without sin. And if you're walking down a path of destruction and you are allowing yourself to even justify that by saying everybody does it, I don't think you understand what we're doing here. I'm not asking you to get out a whip and start scourging yourself. But I am saying, realize, it is possible. It is possible. Am I saying I am without sin? No, I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, that is my goal. And I am better today than I was 10 years ago at this goal. I am. Why? Because it's actually been a goal. And I've worked at it. The same way that you work at a marathon, the same way that you work at a sporting event, the same way that you work in education. Over time, it develops different tracks, different grooves that then you're able to walk down a lot more easier. And if they are ones that just accept sin, your groove's just going to get deeper. And actually what will happen is, you're living in a grace at the surface where sin does happen on occasion, but the more you live in that groove and get comfortable in it, next thing you know, you're not even really living in the grace anymore, you're just living in sin. It's always a process. Every path, every step you take, every exception that you make, every exemption that you make, you take a step down a certain one of these paths. And over time, if you're walking, refusing to walk anywhere but the path of life, you will change and be different. Sins will mitigate in certain areas of your life. Now, whenever those go away, you realize other ones come up, then you start working on them and them. Well, will I ever be perfect? I'm telling you what the goal is through the power of the Holy Spirit and through the power of the resurrection. The goal is for you to become holy as your Heavenly Father is holy. Or for you to be merciful as your Heavenly Father is merciful. Or for you to be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. That is the goal. And to wave a white flag and say, it's not possible, is to deny the humanity of Jesus on some level. It just is. Is this theologically making sense to you, what I'm saying? I know the implications are frightening, but at least admit what you're saying so that we can actually deal with it. I do not understand this. Oh, I'm going to sin anyway. But what? That can't be your agenda. You've got to treat sin a little different than that. It is a violent enemy that is looking to devour you. And accepting its presence on any level is denying some of the permission of the Holy Spirit to transform you into something totally different. You've got to fight it like an enemy. Okay, then he moves on, says, don't judge others. Why? Because he's people-focused. And then he goes on, also says, a tree will bear its fruit. Why? He's people-focused. Right after that, all of the enemy talk, loving your enemies, not judging others, the tree that produces bad fruit, the very next thing that he brings to bear in the conversation, the faith of an enemy. The centurion. That's not an accident. It's not an accident at all. Why? It's because what he is doing is he's trying to show Jesus' true humanity has come to redeem all of humanity, even the evil ones. And that's why it's interesting that in Luke 23, we have a very unique moment. Oh man, I just flipped past Lazarus. The rich man and Lazarus, Luke is the only gospel that's talked about in. The only gospel. It's unique to Luke, rich man and Lazarus. Why? Because his emphasis is on people. Good Samaritan, why does he hammer on that so much? The emphasis is on people. How do we treat them? As a matter of fact, oh, how much time do I have? Crud. Okay. I didn't realize. What have I been talking about? Okay. Luke 23:34. This is unique to Luke's gospel. Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Why is that unique to Luke's gospel? Because the emphasis is on people. Even in the moment whenever people are crucifying you, your job as a follower of Jesus is to pray for them. Reminds me of Stephen, which is also a book written by Luke in Acts. Whenever he is being killed, and he says the exact same thing, Father, forgive them. But they don't know what they're doing. Why? Because whenever you're stating the identity of Jesus, you're not just making a theological affirmation, you're actually suggesting an identity that you are going to embrace. That's why. And inside of Luke's gospel, this is hammered over our heads time and time again. And also that is unique to Luke's gospel is verse 43. Jesus answered them, truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. On the cross, Jesus is ministering to one of the other people that's being crucified. How does that make any sense? It only makes sense if you understand that Jesus, as a true human, has come to redeem all of humanity. I do want to end with this allegorizing of the Good Samaritan. So Luke chapter 10, verses 25 through 37, unique to Luke's gospel. In allegorizing. So, the early church would reinterpret every element in order to point to Jesus. Now, listen to how they interpret it. I find this very interesting. He says, they told it this way. The wounded man was Adam. Wounded by original sin and now exiled outside of the gates of the city, which is paradise. Good Samaritan. So, the man is beaten. Left outside of the gates on the road. They say, that's Adam, wounded by original sin. Neither the law nor the prophets or the priest and the Levite was able to help Adam. Then one not from the land of Adam, Jesus, the Good Samaritan, although he was still human, but he's not from the same land because he's also a second Adam, a new Adam, which we get into once we get into Paul, found Adam, tended to him, and carried him on his mule to the inn, which is the church. There Jesus paid an initial price, our redemption, which will be paid in full when Jesus returns again at the end of time to take Adam into the kingdom. And the way that they describe this allegory, the way they apply it is they say, it's not surprisingly then that Luke exhorts us to be merciful as our Heavenly Father is merciful. Why? Because who is Jesus in the story and who are you? Jesus has brought and broken humanity from the road. He's paid the price of their redemption, and who does he hand them over to be tended to and nursed until he comes again? Who does he hand them over to in the Good Samaritan parable? The inn or the church. It's no wonder that Luke then says, how is Jesus merciful? You be that too. Why? Because his identity defines your identity, and that should lead to your works. Love you guys. See you in the morning.